Hello, seafood friends. You're listening to Catch the Current, the coolest seafood podcast out there from the team at Undercurrent, bringing you everything from the boats to the boardrooms, breaking down the news, spilling a little industry fish oil, and sharing the sharp market insights you need to know. I'm Amanda Buckle.
And I'm Lauren Castiglione. We're kicking this week's episode off with an installment of our favorite soap opera, The Crabby and the Canadian, where tensions in the snow crab sector have escalated dramatically from a pricing dispute to a multi-million dollar lawsuit. Snow crab processors in Newfoundland and Labrador have launched a Canadian $2.5 million lawsuit against two top leaders of the Fish, Food, and Allied Workers Union, better known as FFAW.
The lawsuit targets Union President Dwan Street and Vice President Jason Sullivan. It was filed April 10th in the province's Supreme Court and centers on allegations of intimidation, threats, and what processors are calling an unlawful effort to keep harvesters off the water at the start of the 2026 season. That season officially opened April 5th, but instead of boats heading out, the industry hit a near standstill.
At the heart of the dispute is price. The province's fish price setting panel established a minimum dock price of $5.30 Canadian per pound, but the union made it clear that wasn't enough. In fact, just days before the season opened, FFAW said that there would be, quote, no crab processed until harvesters were paid what they consider a fair price, which they pegged at $6 per pound or higher. Messaging didn't stop there. Union leadership encouraged harvesters to hold the line. And when some fishers chose to go out anyway on opening day, tensions escalated.
Sullivan publicly criticized those harvesters, even going so far as to post their names online, labeling them as crossing the line. Now, processors say actions like that cross into interference, and they're now seeking either $2.5 million Canadian dollars in damages or compensation equal to lost profits suffered by five major companies. The lawsuit also points to events on the ground, including a protest at a local port during the opening weekend of the season. While union leadership was present, they've said the protest itself wasn't officially organized by the FFAW. Still, processors argued the union's involvement contributed to disruptions, and they're asking the court to formally recognize the interference. And then in yet another twist, days later, on Thursday, April 16th, ASP sent out a release announcing that the two parties have finalized an agreement for the 2026 fishing season. So who knows what will happen in between the span when we publish this podcast on Friday, but this all happened Thursday afternoon. They said that the agreement confirms the existing collective agreement remains in place and that the standing fish price setting panel's minimum price decision is final. And this agreement would pay harvesters upfront rather than by a settlement adjustment after the season.
Undercurrent's Barb Dean Simmons is keeping a close eye on the situation, so check out her ongoing coverage on the UCN website.
Now, diving into the lobster market, things are moving fast. And if you blink, you might miss a price swing. The U.S. wholesale lobster market saw a pretty major shakeup in week 16 of 2026, and it all comes down to one thing. Canada is back online.
Canada is back, baby. Several key Atlantic Canada lobster fishing areas opened earlier this month, and more supply is just around the corner. Joining us now to break it all down is Undercurrent America's editor, Jason Huffman, and UCN price reporters, Gary Morrison and Ben Fisher.
Yeah, so I want to start off, this is Jason, I want to start off by talking about an interview I did this week with the owner of a lobster roll franchisor headquartered in Annapolis, Maryland, just up the road from me. Daniel Beck started his first Mason's Famous Lobster restaurant in 2014, which he named after his son, who apparently is allergic to shellfish. He moved to a franchise model in 2016 and now has about 35 franchisee locations in 14 states. Times were great for many years, and growth has always been on the horizon for this company. But for the last two or three years, Beck told me his franchisees have been struggling. The reason, the high cost of claw knuckle meat. At $30 or more per pound, he told me, it's really difficult to sell a lobster roll with 3 ounces of meat for the $20 to $24 his franchisees charge. Once food costs go over 40% of total cost for a restaurant, he said, it's hard to maintain a business. He said 90% of his restaurants are having a down year. Now, here comes the Canadian spring lobster season, when roughly half of the 93,000 to 101,000 metric tons of North American lobster landed per year in Canada is caught over just a three-month period between mid-April and mid-July, swelling the supply exponentially, which you would think would drop prices. But then last spring was disappointing for the lobster harvesters, and they reported their catch was off by about 10 to 15%. So I'm eager to hear from Gary and Ben. Things have started cranking up in Canada about a week ago. What are you guys hearing about the harvest and its impact on prices so far?
Well, the fever has finally broken after these volumes started coming into the U.S. from Canada. After months of elevated pricing with all-time highs hit, all of our live lobster sizes in Undercurrent's U.S. wholesale live lobster price assessment dropped dramatically in week 16. So halves, for example, that's pound and a half lobsters, dropped some $2.50 in our latest assessment. Quarters, pound and a quarter lobsters, dropped 14%. These are some pretty massive numbers. And as we've been talking about, this is due to these new lobster fishing area openings in Canada. The market has been kind of running on fumes throughout the winter in terms of supply, and that's how it goes every year. But sources say that this year in particular was even tighter than most. In terms of the LFAs that have opened, Nova Scotia's 31B and 32 opened on the 9th of this month, and additional areas will be open by the end of the month, with the final LFAs in Nova Scotia opening by May 9th. And the market typically sees a real flood of lobster by this point. But those Nova Scotia lobster fishing areas are just the appetizer, because lobster fishing areas 23 to 26 in the Gulf of St. Lawrence are opening on April 20th. According to data from 2024, the Gulf zone landed some 36,000 metric tons of lobster, which was about a third of the total landed in Atlantic Canada that year. And again, our colleague Barb Dean Simmons is covering this all spectacularly, so I highly recommend anyone listening to have a look at her stories. Our live lobster U.S. wholesale price assessment has been around now for more than a year, so you can have a look at year-on-year pricing to see what things look like the same time the year prior. What happened last year, which is what happens most years, is that prices dropped sharply with the new LFA openings and continue to drop more as more open and more volume arrives. This week, things were quite volatile, our sources tell us, with pricing coming in both above and below and in our reported range. But that volatility should start to sort itself out with more predictable supply.
Thanks, Ben. And I'd like certainly to start off by touching on, you know, something that Jason mentioned before when he talked about lobster rolls and, you know, some of the costs that are going into it, you know, some of the struggles that these restaurateurs and little mom and pop shops are having across the country. You can remember, you know, not too long ago when meat, you know, peaked, and that was around week 37 of 2025, as in a pretty consistent flat line for quite some time until some recent weeks prior to this week's price assessments. Prices dropped 4 out of the last 5 weeks, but it still probably is not as much relief that than these guys want, right? So if you're talking about, you know, a quarter pound of meat, that could, you know, equate to about, you know, $8 to $9 to $10 at current pricing here. And then you add a roll, condiment, and sides such as French fries or coleslaw, labor, rent, and utilities. And you can see why the average price of lobster rolls around the country, you know, hit almost $40 last summer. And with limited, you know, product here, obviously everyone's going to be looking at what new supply comes in during the start of the season that Ben just spoke about. You know, I think there's not many factors that provide relief in sight. There's not much downside risk in terms of pricing, given what's happened in terms of the supply and expectations for what the new season's going to bring. So, you know, Jason, I think, you know, some of these guys are going to have to face the reality that lobster rolls are going to be pretty high again. And the demand destruction, if any, is going to come from the consumer side of the equation, if they can really do it. So going back to pricing over the last couple of weeks, we did see, as I mentioned, discounts 4 out of the last 5 weeks, but that seemed to really reignite buyer interest. We do know that weather broke across many parts of the country. We're starting to see the sun here on the East Coast and warm weather. And I think that perked up some of the buyers because they realized that, you know, lobster roll season is right around the corner. So as they saw some of these discounts get to some of these levels that they hadn't seen in quite some time, It certainly spurred some interest in buying, and we did see activity pick up. But that also limited the spot market supply. So there's not much out there now. So we're going to, you know, continue to watch anything new that comes on. But I think, you know, we're resound to the fact that the market is signaling that potential floor is in place, because the spring rally tends to happen pretty soon. And, you know, I think that's where we're at right now in terms of lobster meat.
You know, I love following the trends in seafood. And one of the things that I've been noticing with lobster rolls is they're still getting a lot of attention. People want them. But what restaurants seem to be doing is kind of elevating them to, you know, explain the reasoning behind that large cost. So I saw one was like a salted caramel lobster roll, which I don't know. Lauren, what are your thoughts on that one?
That doesn't sound good.
That doesn't sound good. Okay, Jason's out.
I could go for it. My ears perked up when you said that. So,
Ben, Gary, as the lobster guys, would you be into a salted caramel lobster roll?
Out. Count me out.
Yeah, definitely out. Definitely
well, it depends
out
on if
well.
You're a mayo or a butter.
Butter guy.
Yeah. So the mayo, maybe mayo not.
But it's trying to show like the indulgence of it. Like a lobster roll isn't indulgent enough. And then the other thing is just that they're still kind of hammering in on these monster lobster rolls too. These like 2 to 3 footers, which, you know, you're really paying the big bucks for. But again, it's kind of like the experience, and people want to be documenting it on their social media. So people are still going for it.
You know, Amanda, I think you hit the nail on the head.
You, Amanda.
Right. If you can give somebody a high quality experience, I think they're willing to pay for it. And, you know, lobster rolls are traditionally eaten while people are on vacation. You know, they're they're expecting to spend a little bit of money, and they want that experience. So as long as these places are providing some of the justification for why prices are so high, I think consumers will continue to look for it and absorb these items.
I have thoughts on this I want to share. Something that I heard from the franchisor that I talked to, he said that when people go on vacation and they buy lobster rolls, their expectation is they're going to pay more for that experience because they're on vacation. But he runs a business that he hopes to have customers come back all across the U.S. like every week. And they're not going to do that on a weekly basis. It's too expensive. So it was kind of interesting, because that – it does put them in a different kind of position.
Jason, I will say, though, lobster has been supplemented as the luxury premium shellfish when it comes to, you know, when you look at the prices of red king crab, you know, certainly much higher. And when you're comparatively speaking to some of the other proteins, it's still a pretty good value. So even if you're paying $30, $40 for a lobster roll, get out there, enjoy it, and then you can go compare it to a steak sandwich, which is probably a lot more.
I'm ready to go, man. I just don't want any caramel on my lobster.
All right. Thanks, Gary. Thanks, Ben. So, Jason, I want to keep you on the line a bit longer to talk about the latest trade war development. U.S. Customs and Border Protection revealed this week that seafood importers and others can expect to start seeing refunds for the tariffs charged illegally by President Donald Trump in June or July. So CBP said it will launch the first phase of its consolidated administration and processing of entries, or CAPE for short, an automated system capable of handling refund requests in relation to the duties unlawfully imposed under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Now, Jason, you did a deep dive into this. What can you tell our listeners about CAPE and this new process?
Right. Well, as we have reported several times recently, the U.S. seafood industry is out about $2.7 billion in relation to the illegal tariffs charged by President Trump between April 2025 and February 2026. That was before the Supreme Court ruling came down on February 20th that sort of stopped the tariffs, at least those tariffs. And we've just been waiting for word from Customs and Border Patrol about how they plan to make good on the refunds. It's kind of one of the things that's come in hanging out there that we haven't addressed. You know, will the Supreme Court rule one way or the other? That was a big question. Then we answered that question. And now it's like, well, how soon will they get paid and how much trouble will it be? Initially, CBP told the U.S. Court of International Trade this was a nearly impossible task because there was so many refunds that had to be taken care of, so much processing. But they said they were making progress with this automated system, the aforementioned CAPE. and hope to get a handle on this quickly. In a memo and then a court filing about a week ago, CBP reported that they were close to being ready to start processing the refunds. They said they expected to have everything ready to go by April 20th. Then they said it would probably take 60 to 90 days to handle the massive backlog. So that does project to mid-June to mid-July from when you might start seeing some checks, seafood companies.
So you've been tracking the seafood companies that have sued the Trump administration for tariff refunds. What's that number up to now? Have there been any big additions?
We're up to 97. That includes some recent additions, Leroy Seafood, Blue Sea Products, Bama Sea Products, and Worldwide Seafood. And of course, there are some really big companies that filed earlier, like Beaver Street Fisheries, Mazetta, Maui, Highliner, Eastern Fisheries, Sensi, Mark Foods. You come up with a name for a big seafood company, good chance they're on that list.
Thanks, Jason. Now, one more story before you go. It broke this week. USDA Secretary Brooke Rollins announced the new USDA Office of Seafood, which will be coordinating across USDA agencies to ensure that fishermen are integrated into USDA programs. Now, we finally have a name. Lauren, I feel like you and I were like, everybody was kind of playing like guess who of who this was going to head this Boston. Up. And we have a name. So Jason, and you actually spoke to him via email, correct?
Yeah, we had an email conversation. My least favorite way to do an interview. I promise you, if you had a list of possible names that you would have thought might have taken this role, you would have not had this person's name. The guy's name is Michael Illenberg, and he is a 20-year USDA staffer. He's not a political guy. And he comes from a communications management background, doesn't really show a lot of seafood experience in that. So it'll be interesting to see how he handles the role. There are a lot of folks who are excited about this that think this could make a big difference. But I don't know if he has any staff yet. I asked him about that. He didn't really acknowledge any staff. He said they're starting to get into that, figuring out the process, who they need to add, and we'll see where they go from there.
And I know this was just announced on Wednesday, and there was quite a few people in attendance that are big in the industry. One of them was actually Joe Bundrant, CEO of Trident. He posted that he was in attendance in DC for this announcement to go down. So I'm looking forward to hearing more companies kind of come forward and say what they hope to accomplish with this new office and what they hope to benefit out of it. Because I feel like we're going to see hopefully some big changes.
You know, before I covered seafood, I covered agriculture policy for a number of years. And when you jump from agriculture to seafood, you see the difference in what USDA does. It's just night and day. The ag industry has always gotten a lot of attention. There are loan programs, they're supported, there's the farm bill. I mean, there's nothing like that for seafood. So I think the seafood industry has felt neglected for years and maybe could use a little protection. Just like agriculture, seafood depends on a lot of conditions. It's wild, especially wild catch. You just don't know what you're going to get from year to year. And there's all these risks associated with that. So, you know, also they would like to have U.S. products promoted domestically and overseas. They haven't really had a federal program for that. So maybe this is the beginning of that.
You know, and obviously Undercurrent is going to be on top of it. So we will be keeping tabs on what's going on with this office and reporting to you. So stay tuned. Thanks, Jason. Now, before we go, we've got an update on the fella that allegedly stole more than 33,000 pounds of snow crab. I had some questions and I got some of those answers. So remember last year, there were quite a few headlines of seafood related cargo thefts. Federal prosecutors say a 31-year-old man, Ramoy Forbes, orchestrated a multi-state cargo theft scheme that snagged roughly 33,750 pounds of snow crab worth about $325,000. And that is just the seafood portion of the story.
Just the seafood?
Yes. So authorities say beer, blueberries, and even designer fragrances.
Quite the shopping list. So how does someone pull off a snow crab heist of this scale?
According to investigators, Forbes and his co-conspirators allegedly impersonated legitimate trucking companies using spoofed emails and even hacking into real cargo company communications.
So basically, they didn't steal the crab with crowbars. They stole it with emails.
That's right. This was like a digital age cargo theft. In this case, the shipment was supposed to travel from a cold storage facility in Massachusetts down to Jacksonville, Florida. Instead, it took a detour to New York, Queens specifically. So prosecutors say Forbes posed as a rep for a trucking company, picked up the crab, and then redirected it to a grocery business for resale. Of course, the name of the grocery business where this crab was delivered to has not been released, and it's not clear the relationship that Forbes had there, but I was surprised to read in the report that the grocery business does have a number of locations in various states. I guess I wasn't expecting something like that to just like turn up at your local grocery store's loading dock, and it made me think about another cargo theft story within the past year or so, where this massive amount of expensive, high quality olive oil was stolen. And they found it because somehow it turned up like at this ridiculously low price at a discount retailer. And then later it was discovered they had been contacting legit retailers of the olive oil who were suspicious of the reduced price. But like a week before I read that story, I had bought that olive oil brand and was all excited.
Stop. Because
I had found it for a great price. So it made me think.
Amanda, you're going to be investigated now.
It made me think, have I accidentally ever bought black market goods, Lauren?
One of my first thoughts when I hear a story about someone stealing a ridiculous quantity of something is, do they know a guy? Because how are you unloading 33,000 pounds of snow crab?
Well, it's funny you say that because some of the documents related to this case actually included some photos and messages. And in one of these photos, there's a message from Forbes to someone in his phone named, and I quote, my guy for everything.
Oh.
But that is not who he contacted for the snow crab. We don't know who his snow crab guy is.
What a story. But in all seriousness, it really underscores just how vulnerable supply chains can be, especially when fraudsters exploit digital systems and trust-based logistics.
Exactly. Now, Forbes was arrested in February 2026 and is facing some serious charges, including interstate transportation of stolen goods, which could mean up to 10 years in prison plus additional conspiracy charges.
Thanks for listening to Catch the Current. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe and stay tuned for more stories shaping the seafood industry.
And next week, I'm hoping to wrangle UCN's Jacob Resnick. He's up in Alaska as we speak, covering Compfish, and then he's heading to Barcelona for Seafood Expo Global. So he's a busy man, but we're going to try to catch up with him and get the scoop on what's going on up in Alaska. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you back here next week.
Bye-bye.